Lecture 12, Personality and Social Relationships.
Human beings are an exceptionally gregarious species. Most of us spend much of our time with other people, and we all maintain many ongoing relationships with family members, romantic partners, friends, co-workers, neighbors, and others. After all, our relationships are important to our happiness and well-being on a daily basis. And most of the best things and most of the worst things that happen to us involve other people in one way or another. Some of the most important differences that we see among people involve their ways of relating to others. We differ in how much we interact with other people, in the kinds of relationships we like to have, in our interpersonal style, and how well we get along with other people, and how we deal with conflicts and other relationship problems in many other ways. We've already talked about several traits that involve social behavior, such as extroversion, agreeableness, affiliation motivation, and power motivation. In this lecture, we're going to look at some additional characteristics that have implications for people's social behavior and close relationships. To begin, people differ in their general approach to relationships with other people in what's known as their attachment style. Interest in attachment began in the 1960s with research on how babies react when they're temporarily separated from their parents. Studies were conducted in which year-old infants and their parents were brought to a research laboratory. Then after a while, the parent was asked to leave the room for a few minutes, and the baby's reaction was observed, both when the parent left and then again when the parent returned. Babies showed quite different reactions. The most common response, which was seen in about 60% of the infants, was that the baby became upset when the parent left the room, but then sought the parent out and quickly calmed down when mom or dad came back. Another 20% of the children also became extremely distressed when the parent left, but the babies in this group had trouble being comforted when their parent came back into the room. The remainder, the other 20%, weren't very upset when the parent left, and they didn't seem to care much when mom or dad came back in. So we have at least three types of babies: those who are secure in their relationship with their parents and are easily calmed, those who are anxious and inconsolable, and those who are indifferent and avoidant. Further research showed that these patterns arise, at least in part, from different parent behaviors. Of course, other factors are also important, including genetic influences, but parenting plays an important role in children's attachment styles. Securely attached children tend to have parents who are consistently responsive to the child's needs. But children who have an anxious or avoidant attachment style tend to have parents who are not very responsive at all, or parents who are inconsistent with how they deal with the child, or parents who tend to be rejecting. But here's the interesting thing. Adults show similar patterns in their close relationships, and the styles that babies establish with their parents can carry over to some extent into adult relationships, including into people's romantic relationships. Once you develop a style of relating to your parents as a baby, that style can generalize to later relationships. In trying to understand these patterns, researchers have discovered that attachment styles are defined by two distinct dimensions. One dimension, called attachment-related anxiety, involves the degree to which people tend to think that other people, such as their parents or their romantic partners, care about them. People who score high on attachment-related anxiety tend to think that other people don't care about them as much as they would like, and that other people aren't sufficiently responsive and supportive. People who score on the low end of this attachment anxiety dimension feel more secure about the responsiveness and commitment of their partners and other people. They're less anxious about whether other people care about them. The second dimension is called attachment-related avoidance, or just attachment avoidance. People on the high end of this avoidance dimension prefer not to rely on other people. They feel uncomfortable getting too close to other people, and they have trouble trusting other people and opening up. People on the low end of the avoidance dimension are more comfortable being close to other people. They find it easier to depend on other people and having others depend on them. So we have two dimensions, one defined by low versus high attachment anxiety, and the other defined by low versus high attachment avoidance. Although these are both continuous dimensions that run from low to high, for convenience, we can think of people being low or high on each dimension, so that when we combine them, people fall into one of four categories. Let's look at each one. Some people are low in both attachment anxiety and in attachment avoidance. These people generally feel confident that their partners and other people care about them and will be there for them when needed, and they're comfortable depending on other people and having others depend on them. These people are generally secure in their close relationships, so we call them securely attached. Other people fall high on both the attachment anxiety dimension, they aren't certain that other people care about them, and on the attachment avoidance dimension. They don't like to get too close to other people and don't want other people depending on them too much. This isn't a great combination for satisfying relationships. If I don't think you care about me very much, and I don't want to be very close to you anyway, I'm not likely to be a very satisfying friend or romantic partner. Then you have people who score low on one dimension but high on the other. Some people score low on attachment anxiety. They aren't worried about whether their partner cares about them, but they're high in avoidance. They like to keep their distance. Those sorts of people can have good relationships, but only if the other person in the relationship is also high in attachment avoidance. That way, both people know that the other person cares, and both are happy not to be too close. But pairing a low avoidance and a high avoidance person together doesn't work very well, because the high avoidance person feels smothered by the low avoidance person's desire for closeness, and the low avoidance person is unhappy with how distant the high avoidance person is. The final attachment style involves being high in attachment anxiety and low in avoidance. These people want to have close relationships with others, but they don't think that people care about them as much as they'd like. As you can imagine, these people tend to have an anxious, dependent sort of relationship style. Of course, how anxious and avoidant people are in their relationships depends on the nature of specific relationships. Particular people can make us feel more or less secure. But attachment style is a trait-like variable that people carry around with them to some extent. People with a secure attachment style, those who are low in attachment anxiety and low in avoidance, tend to be more satisfied in their relationships than the other three categories. Their relationships have higher trust and commitment, and they tend to last longer than the relationships of people who are less securely attached. Among other things, people with a secure style are more likely to seek support from their romantic partner when they're upset, and they're more likely to provide support when their partner needs it. About 60% of American adults seem to have a secure attachment style, and those who don't struggle a bit more in their close relationships. For example, because they worry about how much their partners care about them, people high in attachment anxiety often perceive their partners to be less accepting than they actually are. So they interpret benign reactions as rejecting. And because they're uncomfortable getting close to people or depending on them, people high in attachment avoidance don't capitalize on the support that their relationship partners could potentially provide. So they miss out on many important benefits of close relationships. As I said, whether people are secure or insecure in their relationships as an adult partly reflects their experiences as children. Once children have developed expectations about relationships, such as expectations about whether other people will be responsive and supportive, their reactions throughout life are colored by those expectations. Now, that's not to say that our attachment style is etched in stone since childhood. Not at all. New relationship experiences can revise our expectations about other people and our views of relationships. But early childhood experiences carry a great deal of weight in forming our basic approach to relationships. In all of our relationships, we often want to influence the other person to do something that we want them to do. And of course, they sometimes want to influence us as well. Sometimes the issue is momentous and life-changing, but usually they're pretty mundane. Either way, life is filled with efforts to get other people to do what we want them to do. Of course, people use different tactics for getting other people to do what they want, depending on the relationship and the situation. But we each have some favorite, preferred tactics for influencing other people. Part of your interpersonal style, how you generally interact with other people, involves the tactics that you tend to use when you want to persuade and influence them. And the quality of your close relationships depends to an extent on which tactics you tend to use. Studies that have carefully examined the tactics that people use to get what they want have identified several categories. Sometimes we take a rational approach to influence other people, giving reasons and explanations for why the other person should do what we want them to. At other times, we offer to reciprocate or to reward them. If you do what I want this time, I'll do what you want next time. Or we might try to use personal charm or try to convince the other person that they'll like whatever it is we want them to do. At other times, we suggest that it's the other person's obligation or responsibility to do whatever it is that we want, or that the person should agree to do what we want because it's what most other people would do. Those are all reasonably upfront tactics to get others to do as we wish. But sometimes people use less positive approaches. Sometimes people use coercion or threats. They put the other person down, or they sulk or whine or give the other person the silent treatment until they get their way. There are lots of ways to get other people to do what you want. Of course, people use somewhat different tactics in different relationships. For example, people tend to use charm and coercion more with their romantic partners than with their friends or parents. But for our purposes, the interesting thing is that there's a good deal of consistency in the tactics each of us tends to use across our different relationships. And the tactics that each of us use most frequently relate to our personality. People with different traits tend to use different tactics to influence other people. Some people consistently use reason as an influence tactic across various relationships more than other people do. If you generally take a rational approach, giving reasons and explanations and justifications with your friends, you probably use a rational approach with your partners and family members and coworkers as well. But if you usually don't use reason as a tactic in one relationship, you probably don't use it very much in other relationships either. People who prefer to use rational social influence tactics tend to be people who score higher in conscientiousness and openness. Conscientious people live their own life according to rules and reasons about how things should be done, so they take that approach when trying to persuade other people. And people who are high in openness make their own decisions based on information they receive. So they assume that other people are also open to changing their mind if given the right reasons. If we look at people who tend to use the more negative influence tactics, such as coercion and the silent treatment, those people tend to be low in agreeableness. People who are lower in agreeableness are more inclined to yell, demand, criticize, or otherwise extort agreement from other people than highly agreeable people are. Similarly, people who whine, pout, throw tantrums to get what they want, tend to be higher in neuroticism. In each case, people's favorite tactics are a reflection of their personality. If you think about these findings from the standpoint of someone who is in a relationship with a person who uses various tactics, you'll see how a person's personality has implications for the kind of relationship their partner will have. For example, people who are in relationships with people who are low in agreeableness are more likely to be subjected to demands and criticism and yelling than people whose partners are higher in agreeableness. Likewise, people whose partners are high in neuroticism are more likely to be the target of pouting and sulking and whining, as well as to angry demands and criticism than people whose partners are low in neuroticism. So, if you'd like your partner to approach discussions and disagreements reasonably, you might want to look for someone who is higher in agreeableness, conscientiousness, and openness, and lower in neuroticism. While we're talking about how people try to influence others, let me say something about people who are downright manipulative. You have probably heard of Niccolò Machiavelli, the Italian politician, historian, and philosopher. Machiavelli is best known for his book, The Prince, written in the 1500s, in which he suggested that political rulers should use whatever means necessary to maintain power and to control their citizens. According to Machiavelli, people in positions of power should feel free to use deceit, treachery, and force to achieve their political goals. Although Machiavelli was addressing his recommendations to political leaders, you've probably known people who approach everyday life in the way that Machiavelli recommended. Never being ones to ignore another dark, maladaptive trait, psychologists have developed measures of this tendency that simply ask people whether they agree or disagree with statements that reflect Machiavelli's recommendations. So, for example, people who score high in Machiavellianism agree more strongly that the best way to handle people is to tell them what they want to hear, and that it's wise to flatter important people than people low in Machiavellianism. On the other hand, people low in Machiavellianism agree more strongly with statements such as, one should take action only when sure it is morally right. And, all in all, it's better to be humble and honest than to be important and dishonest. People who are high in Machiavellianism live their lives in a highly selfish fashion, guided by their belief that it's okay to do whatever it takes to achieve their goals. So whatever they're trying to obtain or achieve, Machiavellians tend to pursue their desires in underhanded, duplicitous, and manipulative ways. Machiavellians report that they more often lie and cheat, and that they use charm, flattery, and deceit to get people to do what they want. They also say that they often don't intend to honor their agreements and commitments. They promise to do things in order to get other people to do what they want and then ignore their agreements. They also like to guilt people into doing what they want. Machiavellians aren't necessarily trying to hurt anybody, and they often use mild manipulation and deception before turning to pressure and threats. Their goal is to get what they want however they can, and they don't worry much about what happens to other people in the process. Not surprisingly, Machiavellians score very low in both agreeableness and conscientiousness. You know, most of us would feel horrible going through life manipulating people. But Machiavellians are able to do it because they're rather emotionally detached and non-empathic. They also have fewer qualms about behaving unethically. And they have a dismissive, avoidant attachment style, along with a negative view of other people as basically selfish and manipulative. So Machiavellians think that it's a dog-eat-dog world out there, and it only makes sense that each of us has to look out for ourselves. Machiavellian tendencies have been identified in children as young as age 10 or 11. But where does Machiavellianism come from at such a young age? Like most characteristics, both nature and nurture are involved. About 30% of the variability that we observe in Machiavellianism across people is due to genetic factors, though it's not clear exactly what tendencies are being inherited. The remaining 70% of the variability in Machiavellianism is due to an assortment of situational and social factors. Most notably, about 40% of the variability in Machiavellianism can be explained by family variables, including parental effects. One interesting study showed that the children of parents who scored high in Machiavellianism are better liars. In this study, children played a game in which they were instructed to bluff another child. The more Machiavellian a child's parents were, the more likely other kids would believe the child when he or she lied. So, observing and modeling Machiavellian parents is one route to becoming a Machiavellian. To wrap up this lecture on personality and social relationships, let's look at a somewhat more socially desirable characteristic than Machiavellianism. An important determinant of successful relationships is the degree to which people in a relationship are attuned to what each other is thinking and feeling. We all want our relationship partners to understand us, to understand our goals, our reasons for doing things, our emotions, our preferences, and our pet peeves. In a word, we want our partners to be empathic. Yet, people differ in empathy, and these differences are related both to people's behavior and to the quality of their social relationships. Researchers distinguish three aspects of empathy. Cognitive empathy involves understanding what other people are thinking, the ability to take another person's perspective. Emotional empathy involves understanding what other people are feeling, and sometimes even feeling it ourselves. The third aspect of empathy, empathic concern, involves feeling tenderness, sympathy, or compassion for someone who is distressed and wanting to make them feel better. Most of the time, cognitive empathy, emotional empathy, and empathic concern go together, but not always. For our purposes, we'll just think of these things together and refer to differences in how attuned people are to other people's thoughts and emotions as dispositional empathy. You won't be surprised to hear that the relationship partners of people who are higher in dispositional empathy report being more satisfied with their relationships than the partners of people who are lower in empathy. But perhaps more surprisingly, people high in dispositional empathy are themselves more satisfied with their relationships as well. Interestingly, both partners in a relationship benefit if even just one of them is reasonably empathic. In some studies of couples in long-term relationships, one person, we'll call him or her partner A, reported on what he or she was thinking and feeling while the couple discussed a relationship problem together. Then partner B guessed what partner A had been thinking and feeling during their conversation. The more similar partner B's guesses were to what partner A was actually thinking and feeling, the higher both individuals rated their overall satisfaction with the relationship. In other words, couples in which even one partner perceived the other's thoughts and feelings accurately were more satisfied with their relationship than couples in which neither person was empathic. People higher in dispositional empathy also meet their partner's emotional needs better than people who are less empathic. One experiment found that people who scored higher in dispositional empathy gave their partner more emotional support when researchers put the partner in a stressful situation during the study. Another study found that married people who were higher in dispositional empathy were more likely to forgive their partners for various relationship transgressions, presumably because they could put themselves in their partner's shoes more easily. And as a result, both they and their partners were more satisfied with the relationship. Dispositional empathy is also a benefit in professional settings, particularly for people who are in people-related or helping professions. Teachers, doctors, counselors, therapists who are higher in dispositional empathy seem to be more effective in their professional roles, which leads to better educational outcomes for their students, better physical health for their patients, and better psychological outcomes for their clients. Empathy-related characteristics are also related to better physical health and higher psychological well-being. Highly empathic people report lower stress, lower anxiety, less hopelessness, and lower depression, and they show better physiological indicators of stress regulation. The evidence isn't entirely clear, but these effects seem to be partly due to the fact that empathic people have more rewarding, supportive relationships. Being empathic helps people to avoid and solve relationship problems and thus minimize stress in their relationships. And we know that having strong, satisfying relationships promotes better physical health and psychological well-being. So empathic people personally benefit from their high level of empathy. Where does dispositional empathy come from? Why are some people more empathic than others? Like most characteristics, dispositional empathy does have a genetic basis. Although, interestingly, the ability to infer other people's emotions is more highly heritable than the ability to infer what other people are thinking. In one study, researchers recruited over 700 pairs of siblings, some of whom were identical twins, and some of whom were fraternal twins and non-twin siblings, just regular brothers and sisters. Emotional empathy was assessed using the mind in the eyes test, which asks people to look at 40 photographs just of people's eyes and to indicate what emotion they think the person is experiencing. The participants also completed measures that assessed whether they could tell what other people were thinking. By statistically comparing the performance of identical twins versus other siblings on these tasks, the researchers found that only about a fourth of the variability in cognitive empathy was associated with genetic factors. But over half of the variability in emotional empathy was associated with genetics. Of course, parenting also plays an important role in empathy. Many studies have examined parenting and empathy, and the findings show three aspects of parents' behavior are central in promoting children's empathy. First, because it's hard to learn to be attuned to other people's needs when one's own needs are not being met, a family environment that satisfies the child's own emotional needs and that discourages excessive self-concern tends to promote empathy. Children who know that they are cared for find it easier to care about other people. Second, children who are encouraged to experience and express their emotions tend to turn out more empathic. One longitudinal study showed that mothers who who were more tolerant of their 5-year-old's overly dependent behavior raised children who, when studied again in their early 30s, over 25 years later, were more empathic. Why? Mothers who tolerated excessive dependency in their children conveyed responsiveness, nurturance, and acceptance of the child's feelings. Not only did they model empathic behavior, but a person must have a full emotional life to identify with other people's experiences. Parents who ignore or criticize or shut down their child's emotional reactions can create a child who is not attuned to what other people feel. Tolerant mothers allowed their children to experience their emotions and indirectly taught them how to respond empathically to other people's distress. Third, as suggested by the study I just mentioned, parents who model being emotionally sensitive and responsive promote empathy. For example, that same longitudinal study found that adults whose fathers were more involved in childcare when they were 5 years old were more empathic in their 30s. Presumably, fathers who are more involved in childcare model greater responsivity than fathers who are less involved. The nature of people's relationships, including how close, conflicted, and satisfying they are, is directly influenced by the personalities of the people involved. We have different kinds of relationships because we are different kinds of people. We've taken a look at just 4 personal characteristics that relate to how people manage and mismanage their social relationships: attachment style, tactics of social influence, Machiavellianism, and dispositional empathy. Of course, many other personality characteristics have implications for relationships as well. In understanding people's relationship behaviors, the picture gets complicated because what happens in a relationship is affected not only by the personalities of each of the individuals, but also by the ways in which those 2 personalities interact with each other. Whether you, personally, are extroverted or introverted certainly has implications for how you act in your relationships. But to see the whole picture, we have to consider your partner's level of extroversion as well. If you're both highly extroverted, things are going to play out differently than if you are high and your partner is low in extroversion, for example. Given the intricacies and interdependencies that arise as people with different personalities interact with one another, social relationships can get pretty complicated. Yet, our ability to make sense of our relationships and resolve relationship problems is critical to our success in our careers, our friendships, and our close relationships, and to our overall happiness and well-being.